Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're taking a really hard look at what happens after the storm. Specifically, we're drawing on some powerful reflections about hurricane resilience, looking back at events like Irma in 2017 and, well, the more recent Hurricane Melissa in 2025 in the Caribbean.
Right. And the sources we're diving into, they really challenge that common idea, that surviving a disaster is just luck or some kind of personal blessing.
So our mission here is to pull out the insights, the blueprint maybe, for how communities can move beyond just reacting to
And
disasters.
get into proactively building systems that are truly regenerative. And this whole discussion really hangs on this one core idea. It's often credited to West African elders.
Which is?
When we pray, we must all move our feet.
Okay, let's break that down. Because prayer here isn't what most people might think, is it? It's not about like wishing the storm away or hoping your roof stays on while your neighbor's doesn't.
No, not at all. The sources redefine it. Prayer, in this sense, isn't a plea for exemption. It's a commitment to reality, to aligning our intentions with real material action.
So if you're praying for safety,
You have to commit to building safe things, to building protective systems. True prayer, in this context, is that deep commitment to collective change, to life-sustaining transformation. It connects, the spiritual hope to the actual physical work.
got it. Action as prayer. So, okay, let's start with the storm itself, the hurricane. Our sources are very clear on this. A hurricane isn't personal, it doesn't negotiate.
It's pure physics, really. Planetary regulation. You can think of it like a massive heat engine just working to balance out energy across the globe. Thermodynamics, fluid dynamics.
But not morality. It's not judging anyone.
Absolutely not. It's impartial. It doesn't punish or pick favorites.
Okay, so if the storm itself is just physics, then the destruction we see, the flattened schools, the collapsed roofs, our sources argue that's not the real disaster, that the suffering, the grief, the homelessness, that's actually manufactured by us. How does that work?
It's a tough concept, but think of the storm as a mirror, a really harsh mirror. It doesn't actually create new problems. It just brutally highlights the vulnerabilities we're already living with, the ones we chose, consciously or not.
Like where we built.
Exactly, right on the coast, in floodplains. And it shows what infrastructure projects we put off, deeming them too expensive, maybe roof upgrades or better drainage.
And it also shows what we destroyed.
Yes, the natural defenses. The wetlands we paved over, the reefs we damaged, the mangroves we cut down for beachfront views. Those weren't just scenery, they were buffers.
So the suffering isn't just bad luck, it's a result of, well, systems that prioritize cheapness now over safety later.
Precisely. Economic systems rewarding the absolute cheapest way to build. Governance systems treating vital infrastructure like an optional expense. And maybe even a culture that sort of encourages us to think of community support as optional, not essential.
The storm just strips away the illusions.
It does. But here's the hopeful part, the liberating part the sources emphasize. If the disaster, the suffering part, is constructed by our choices,
And we can reconstruct it differently.
we can. We don't have to just rebuild the same vulnerabilities. We can actually redesign for genuine resilience. And that redesign, that reconstruction, it forces us to get back to basics, to what really supports life. There's this philosopher, John McMurtry, who called it the life ground.
The life ground. What does that mean practically?
It's everything required for us to take our next breath. The absolute non-negotiables, clean air, clean water, stable ecosystems, but also critically, the social connections, the relationships that keep us functioning. McMurtry's point is pretty stark. Any civilization, ultimately, is judged by whether it protects and enables these life systems. If it doesn't, it's already failing, whether a storm hits or not.
And our sources argue we've got this completely backwards right now. We treat money as real and nature as kind of disposable.
Yeah, a fundamental reversal of value. Money, the symbol, becomes the goal. Well, the actual stuff of life, the ecosystems, the social bonds, they become collateral damage or things to be exploited for that money.
But isn't some level of resource use necessary for building things, for progress?
Of course, but it's about the basis of value. When short-term profit is the only driver, that mangrove forest looks like undeveloped land. That reef is just a nice view. It has no value on the balance sheet.
Until the storm hits.
Exactly. Then suddenly that mangrove wasn't wasted space. It was a multi-million dollar seawall. That reef wasn't just pretty. It was a critical breakwater saving homes and lives.
And that neighbor you barely knew
Becomes your lifeline. The first responder, the person sharing water, the one checking in. The storm proves their immense value.
So, bringing it back to that idea of prayer as action.
The commitment has to be to the life ground, rooting our values, our investments, our actual physical building in what genuinely sustains life, not just what extracts profit for a few.
Because building on anything else, profit alone, ideology.
Is building on sand. It's just not stable. The commitment to the life ground isn't just ethical, it's practical, it's survival.
Okay, so if we reroot our values in this life ground, how do we actually, move our feet? How do we build differently? This is where visionaries come in, right? People like Jacques Fresco.
Right. Fresco and others looked at our built environment through the lens of a resource-based economy. They asked a fundamental question: what would we build if resilience wasn't an afterthought, but the starting point?
Instead of just asking what's the cheapest way.
Precisely. Fresco focused on designing for maximum safety, maximum duration, maximum function for human well-being, not just minimum cost according to current market logic.
So what did that look like structurally?
Well, some really interesting ideas. He proposed circular cities, for instance, not just for looks, but because that shape helps diffuse high winds, there are fewer flat surfaces to catch the full force.
Aerodynamics for a whole city.
Kind of, yeah. And buildings designed with flexible reinforced shells. Think less like a rigid box that shatters and more like a strong tree that can bend and absorb force without breaking.
I like that, the high-tech willow tree idea. And he also talked about systems, right? Not just structural.
Absolutely critical. Distributed systems. Instead of one huge power plant that takes everyone down when it fails.
Which we see happen all the time.
Right. He championed local energy microgrids. Redundancy, same for food, bringing production much closer to where people actually live. Vertical farms, inside cities, things like that, reduces dependence on long, fragile supply chains.
All makes sense. But here's the pivot our sources make, and it feels crucial. You could build the most perfect, windproof, resource-efficient city, and it could still fail catastrophically if the people inside aren't resilient. You can't have hurricane-proof cities without hurricane-proof communities.
That's the core insight. A strong roof doesn't help someone who's completely isolated and alone when disaster strikes. And this gets to the heart of it. Why do people suffer so much, even in supposedly advanced societies after a disaster? If the buildings hold up okay, what's the actual failure point?
And the sources point to something less visible.
Yeah. The quiet crisis, the erosion of the human bond, the social fabric wearing thin.
Because so much of modern life pushes us towards
Done.
individualism, competition, self-reliance above all else. We're almost trained to face crises alone.
We are. We tend to privatize resilience. We think it's about having my generator, my supplies, but that turns a collective need into this crushing individual burden.
And there's actual science backing this up, isn't there? The need for connection.
Oh, absolutely. The work by researchers like Julianne Holt Lundstedt is startling. They've shown that social isolation, just feeling alone, is one of the biggest risk factors for early death.
More than smoking or obesity.
Stronger predictor than either of those, yeah. We're wired for connection. Our nervous systems literally regulate better, we heal faster, we cope better when we're embedded in supportive relationships. It's biological.
It reminds me of concepts like dislocation people being torn from those traditional community contexts, leaving them feeling adrift and vulnerable.
Exactly. That isolation creates real pain, and it makes people less able to cope when big external shocks happen. They lack the immediate support network.
So the real tragedy isn't just the tree falling on the house.
It's the absence of the neighbors who would have come together to help clear it, or the lack of a system to check on the elderly person living alone down the street.
Resilience isn't just about concrete and steel.
Fundamentally, no. Resilience is relationship. If we've forgotten how to genuinely show up for each other, how to build and maintain those bonds, no amount of clever engineering can save us from the deepest impacts of a crisis.
Okay, so resilience is relationship. That's the big takeaway. Now, how do we translate that plus the architectural ideas into actual action? How do we, move our feet? The sources talk about a coherence turn. What's that?
Coherence is about alignment, making sure our physical structures, our social structures, our rules, our culture, all of it lines up with the goal of sustaining life across all levels.
So the way we design a neighborhood should match how we manage the coastline.
Basically, yes. It all needs to point in the same direction, supporting life and resilience. So the sources lay out about seven key pathways, seven concrete ways to move our feet.
Okay, let's run through them. Pillar one, reweave the social fabric. Community is infrastructure.
Right. This means getting intentional about building connections, not just hoping they happen. Think structured neighborhood circles, maybe monthly potlucks, skill shares, and things like mutual aid phone trees, where everyone knows who they need to check on before the storm hits.
Making belonging practical. Pillar two, restore the life ground. Ecological defense is self-defense.
This is about actively rebuilding our natural buffers, community-led mangrove replanting, wetland restoration projects, getting legal protections for these areas, treating damage to them like damage to critical infrastructure, not just a minor environmental issue.
Makes sense. Pillar three, build for the storm that will come. This sounds like the Fresco-inspired stuff. Continuity over convenience.
Yes. We need mandatory high-performance building codes everywhere vulnerable, using those flexible, load-absorbing designs, prioritizing aerodynamics, no more cutting corners for short-term profit when lives are at stake. The burden of proof needs to shift.
Right. Prove it safe. Pillar four, local energy sovereignty, decentralized power.
Crucial. Invest heavily in community solar, microgrids, maybe wind co-ops. So when the main grid inevitably goes down, neighborhoods still have power for essentials, water pumps, refrigeration for medicine, communication. That prevents cascading failures.
Energy independence as local resilience. Pillar five, learning as culture. Education shifts focus.
Education needs to be about resilience and cooperation, not just individual achievement. Schools become hubs for ecological literacy, understanding the local environment, and training centers for practical skills. First aid, resource management, adaptive thinking for the whole community.
Okay. Pillar six, governance for the life ground, moving beyond politics as usual.
Governance has to focus on long-term stewardship, not just short-term transactions or patronage. One concrete example, participatory budgeting for resilience projects. Let citizens have a direct say in how preparedness and recovery funds are spent. It builds trust and targets real needs. And the last one, pillar seven, ritual repair, healing together.
This feels important, but maybe overlooked. What does it mean?
After collective trauma, you need collective healing. Intentional community gatherings, feasts, storytelling sessions, memorials where people can process the experience together, acknowledge the loss, and reaffirm their commitment to each other and the future. Without that, recovery can feel hollow. With it, it's genuine rebirth. Hashtag tag outro.
So putting it all together, this deep dive shows it's not just about cleaning up after a storm. It's really a call for a fundamental civilizational reorientation. And the storms themselves are kind of forcing the issue, accelerating the need for change.
They are. And the knowledge is there. The resources are often there. It comes down to remembering what truly matters between the storms and acting on it.
The sources propose this idea of a covenant of the living. What's that about?
It's like a vow. A collective promise to live with the living world intelligently and respectfully, not just constantly fighting against it or exploiting it. It means actively restoring the land, respecting the water, reweaving that social fabric, and really thinking about what kind of ancestors we want to be.
Because just rebuilding the same old thing piece by piece.
That's not resilience. The sources call it amnesia, forgetting the hard lessons.
The storm isn't the enemy. It's the mirror showing us our choices.
Exactly. And when the winds return, and they will, we need to be standing differently. Together, on land we've helped heal, in structures designed for life, within communities that have practiced being lifelines for each other.
So we'll leave you, our listeners, with this thought to mull over. We've heard today that belonging, that connection, is maybe the first, most fundamental architecture of resilience. Knowing that, what will you start building or rebuilding in your own life, in your own neighborhood today? How will you strengthen those connections that might just be the difference next time the wind blows?